Hello and welcome to this Australian Family Physician podcast. I'm your host, Professor Steve Margolis, and today we welcome Associate Professor Terry Boland to the microphone to talk about patients with wind problems in their bowels. He is the Associate Professor of Medicine, University of New South Wales, and the Gastrointestinal Liver Clinic in Sydney. More detailed information can be found in the article in the May 2013 edition of AFP. Professor Boland, thanks for your time in talking to AFP Audio.
Pleasure, Steve.
Perhaps we could first talk briefly about the physiology. For example, what's the role of intestinal gas in the genesis of common symptoms?
Well, it's much more complicated than we were ever taught at medical school, I believe. And it really starts at the top end with eating, and each time we eat, we swallow some air, which contains oxygen and nitrogen. The oxygen's mostly absorbed in the stomach, as is much of the nitrogen. And then we get to the place of real interest these days, and that's in the small intestine. And the interaction of gastric acid and pancreatic bicarbonate starts to generate carbon dioxide gas in considerable amounts of up to 3 litres a day, which is largely reabsorbed as it goes down through the small intestine. But if there is a problem with the motility in the small intestine, you can trap this gas and get bloating, which is quite high in the abdomen, and comes on soon after eating. We then come to what I would call the fermentation chamber in the colon, where there are 1 to 2 kilograms of bacteria of 400 different species. And the fiber and starch that reach the colon, having traversed the small intestine, are then fermented. And then we have another production, a serious production of gases, which is hydrogen, carbon dioxide, and they're converted to methane, and we also have hydrogen sulfide gas, which is present in about 40% of women, 40% of men, and slightly less women. And that whole total of gas is about 25 litres of gas. So you've got to dispose of that either by reabsorption and expiry on the breath, or by muscular activity in the bowel. So it's a hive of activity.
Okay, so just to recap, so the main gases then are?
Well, they're hydrogen, carbon dioxide converted to methane, or hydrogen sulfide gases, with carbon dioxide particularly in the small intestine.
Perhaps we can next talk about belching, or by its technical name, eructation. What are the key issues here?
I think there is usually a cause that you can find. I'm not a great believer in this being a psychological problem. I think you will often find something in the esophagus, either esophagitis from acid reflux or eosinophilic esophagitis. But if you do an endoscopy, you must take biopsies. And then you can get poor muscular activity, especially in the elderly who are unable to eat a large meal. They often have dysphagia for solids and liquids, and their ability to eat is compromised by epigastric pain and bloating. And in younger people, you might get gastroparesis, which seems to be a little more common in these days, and it might occur sometimes with conditions like scleroderma, largely because of poor muscular activity.
You're suggesting then with this problem, a gastroscopy is really the key investigation?
I think so. I don't believe that you should label it psychogenic without exploring the options, and you can't explore those without an endoscopy and biopsy. So I think it's easy to do and well worth the results.
And then that would give you a focus therapy at the end.
It would.
Perhaps we can now talk about passing gas from the anus. Do you want to walk us through the physiology and how you approach this problem with your patients?
Well, of that 25 litres of gas that you will produce during the day, and most of that comes from the colon, a lot of it's reabsorbed, but you are going to pass somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 litres of gas per day as flatus. And that might be primarily volume of flatus, and that's usually methane producers, or in a minority, it's going to be aromatic gas, and that's the sulfide producers that will produce hydrogen sulfide gas. And it's passed either in small or large amounts, and women tend to be more circumspect about passing gas than men. Diet plays a huge role in this, because if you eat a high-fiber diet, then you're going to pass a lot of gas. That's inevitable. And often that is reassuring to many people, because they were eating a high-fiber diet. That's why you're passing gas. Don't worry about it. And only rarely, if the gas is very smelly, will that be associated with problems like ulcerative colitis, for example.
So if a patient with this problem presents to their general practice, does that mean that they require a colonoscopy, or would you suggest that they try a dietary approach initially?
I'd probably ask who's there. Is it the husband or the wife, and who's the complainant? And find out whether it's volume or aroma. Now, if it's volume, then you've got to look at the diet, particularly in terms of fibre and starch. If it's aroma, then you will be born with that particular bacterial population. And that can be modified often by, I would use, a substance that contained bismuth, and that's available through compounding pharmacists, if it's a real issue. But if it's very aromatic and there is diarrhea, then you must exclude ulcerative colitis.
Now let's talk about bloating, which I think would probably be the most common of the three different problems we're going to talk about today, and seems to be quite difficult to both diagnose and manage in general practice and in the wider community. Perhaps you'd like to outline the pathophysiology of this problem and differential diagnoses.
Well, it is extraordinarily common, and about two-thirds of women will complain of bloating. And of that two-thirds, nearly 20% will be really compromised by the bloating, in that it interferes with their social life or work, because the bloating is frequently accompanied by pain. We used to believe that bloating was just one size fits all over the abdomen, worse later in the day, thank you very much, due to fibre. But we now know that about a quarter of women will complain of upper abdominal bloating, some will have it in the mid-abdomen, some low down, and the rest all over. And I think the bloating that occurs high up, especially if it's after a meal, is due to release of carbon dioxide in the small intestine, and then it's trapped. That can also apply to mid-abdominal bloating. And that occurs later in the day and is all over is much more likely a consequence of the fibre and starch that you've eaten during the day and is fermented so that accumulates later in the day. It's often difficult to understand why some people are distressed by it. I think that in our experience, we've explored the problem of the autonomic nervous system and judged that by the symptoms of cold hands and feet. And many women with severe bloating have that, so that their bowel, for some reason, is more sensitive to gaseous distension by the gases that are normally produced. And it may also interfere with the normal motility of the bowel and movement of gases downwards. And again, you've got to accept that there are a large number of treatments that you might try. Fibre in the diet, fat in particular will trigger dysmotility, as will coffee and chocolate. And many people don't realise that a lot of the fat they eat is hidden. If they have, an obvious KFC or whatever, then they recognize that, or chips. So you've got to deal with the diet. You've got to look at antispasmodics such as mebivirine or buscopan. I often use a herbal solution, Iberogast, because that's the only herbal solution I know of that's been evaluated by the TGA and shown that it may affect the neuromuscular system of the gut. Amitriptyline in a tiny dose, not antidepressant dose, 5 to 10 milligrams at night, reduces the sensitivity of the nervous system in the gut. There are a number of popular agents around that include charcoal or peppermint oil. They work. Probiotics also work. The FODMAP diet is got a lot of popularity recently. Most of the FODMAPs are, in fact, foods that
produce a lot of gas because they're fermented. And if someone's eating a lot of fruit juice or fruit, then I would modify that. And there really are a lot of things that you can try.
Do you think there are any sort of formal investigations that are warranted earlier in the piece?
Not necessarily. I think you need to exclude celiac disease, and you can do that with an antibody test. If there are bowel symptoms, then I think they warrant their own evaluation with either endoscopy and or colonoscopy. I think exploration of the diet is a good way to go, because many people don't really understand where they get their fibre from and how they might modify that. And I think the fact that the doctor has an interest in what they say is a major part of their subsequent improvement, because many patients will have been to other practitioners and been dismissed, so to speak, partly because the bloating isn't always accompanied by abdominal distension. And because there's not much to show, they're told, well, it's all in your mind, and they go away and live with it. And I think that's the wrong approach.
Thank you very much for that. Just to sum up, what do you think are the key take-home points from our discussion?
Well, I think that there's often a recognisable cause that you can find through exploration of the history, either diet and other triggers like cold hands and feet, how long it's been there, whether they're female or not. And I think if you show an interest in their symptoms, even though you might be able to explain them all or treat them all satisfactorily, everyone will be much happier.
I think that's an excellent point to leave it. That's the end of today's podcast. Many thanks to Professor Boland for his informative discussion. For listeners, there's more information on this topic if you refer to the full article titled WIND, Problems with Intestinal Gas, which can be found in the Australian Family Physician May 2013 edition.